Welcome to the JOMA podcast, presented by the Jewish Orthodox Women's Medical Association. Every week, hear from expert medical professionals as they share up-to-date insights on health topics to help you live your best life physically, mentally, and emotionally. Join us as we navigate the ever-changing landscape of healthcare and strive to improve the health of the Orthodox Jewish community.
Welcome back to the JOMA podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Jenny Berkovich, board-certified pediatrician and JOMA's Director of Education. Today's episode is with guest Lizzie Savetsky, and if you don't know who she is, you absolutely will after this episode. Lizzie is a leading Jewish influencer and pro-Israel activist. She started her online journey over a decade ago, actually being a fashion blogger, but ultimately transitioned to focusing more exclusively on Jewish and Israel content. She has spoken publicly about her struggles with alcohol and her challenges with infertility and pregnancy loss. She's worked to destigmatize these topics and help thousands to feel less alone. She was a dedicated voice for Israel long before October 7th, but in the past few months, she has used her platform to support Israel, interview families of hostages and survivors of the massacre, support Jewish college students, and educate her followers about the increase in anti-Semitism around the world. If you haven't seen some of the videos that she's done or the interviews that she's conducted, I highly recommend you check them out. They are extremely powerful and inspirational. Originally from Fort Worth, Texas, Lizzie lives in New York City with her husband, Dr. Ira Savetsky, a renowned plastic surgeon, and their children. It was such an incredible episode for me to be able to talk to Lizzie. We covered a whole bunch of topics from alcohol use disorder to being a Jew in the current climate and to her amazing work being an activist for the Jewish community. I hope you enjoy. Hi, Lizzie. Welcome.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be here.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to talk. We have a lot to cover. You have been such a public advocate for the Jewish community for such a long time. So I have so many questions to ask about that. But really, you first came on my radar when I read your article a few years ago that you wrote for AISH. And at the time, you were writing about your challenges with alcohol and how you sort of came to the realization that it was a problem. One thing that I was always curious about is at the time you wrote the article, you already had quite a platform, right? You were blogging and right, you had your blog, you had a social media platform, you definitely had a following. Why was it important for you to share your challenges with alcohol at all? And why did you choose sort of AISH as a way to do that when you had so many other avenues?
You know, it was a really difficult decision for me. I felt very protective of my sobriety. The article went live on my 1 year anniversary of my sobriety. And I really wasn't sure if I was ready to open up about it, because obviously with alcoholism, it's a day-to-day battle. And at any point, I could lose it. And so the last thing I would ever want was to be like the poster child for a woman in recovery and then disappoint everyone or have them think that recovery doesn't work. And so I had a lot of thoughts going into it, but ultimately I decided that it was important to talk about it. One, because it is so stigmatized and there is so much shame around this topic, a lot of self-blame, and a lot of embarrassment, especially in our Jewish community. I feel like no matter what level of observance you are, the Jewish people as a whole stereotypically like to present this image of everything being perfect, and even more so in the more religious communities. And I know that it is a growing problem in our world and in the Jewish community. And I just felt like if I had known there was someone out there like me who was struggling and was able to get help, that would have helped me. And so I just felt like if I could help one person through this article, then it would be worth it to me. And the reason I chose AISH, I actually met Sarah Pachter, who wrote the article. She was writing for AISH at the time. And she's a very well-known Torah teacher and parent advisor. I had met her on a Passover program, and I'd spent a lot of time with her walking on the beach and telling her about my sobriety journey, and she felt like this was something that would deeply resonate within the Jewish community. And because I felt so protective of my sobriety, I felt like sharing it within my world with Aisha as a platform felt safer, and also felt just like the right thing to do, as opposed to kind of handing it over to a much more mainstream publication that maybe would exploit it. And that's not what I wanted to happen, because this is a very severe life or death disease. And I wanted to make sure that it was presented as such.
That makes a lot of sense. I think since I read that article, more and more similar articles have come to my attention, both in mainstream Jewish media and publications, and more so outside of the community. People felt like it was more accepted and felt more comfortable sharing their own personal stories. One theme that keeps coming up over and over, and one thing that even you mentioned, just in terms of not having necessarily other examples of challenges like that, is the lack of resources. So I'm curious how you see this right now, specifically in the Jewish community. Do you think we have good resources for people with alcohol use disorder or people who are having challenges with alcohol? Or is that something that we're still trying to work on?
I think that there are more and more resources out there. I know I've done some work with Amudim, which has which is an amazing resource for anyone suffering through addiction, mental health. It's broader. For me personally, I sought recovery outside of the Jewish world. For me, it's not a religious thing. But I do think that it should be presented as an option for people in the more sheltered Jewish community who are struggling to just know that they can get help. And I know, like, I've discovered over the past 2.5 years of my sobriety that there are specifically Jewish recovery programs. Just for me, I didn't need that. Like, my sobriety and recovery program are a little bit separate from my Jewish life, but my sobriety is fully focused on my sobriety. But I will say that through getting sober with a 12-step recovery program, my relationship with my Jewish identity and my spiritual connection has gotten so much stronger, because I fully believe that the only way to stay sober, and not just physically sober, but emotionally sober, is by having a personal relationship with God, with a higher power, and being able to understand and remind myself moment by moment that I'm only in control of so much, and I have to hand the rest over to God. I can't stay sober without that being at the forefront of my mind.
I love that. That's very powerful. What's the difference between physical and, I think you said, emotional sobriety? How are those two separate?
So alcohol and other substances are really just the symptom of a much deeper problem. It's really a soul sickness. It's like this God-sized hole inside of you that you're trying to fill with external things. And this can be anything from a shopping addiction, a love addiction. A lot of people have, become obsessed with a person, whatever it may be that is not, that you're trying to fill that spiritual void with. And so even if you are physically sober, let's say you're no longer using alcohol and drugs to fill that God-sized hole, but you're not spiritually connected, you're not going to be emotionally sober. You're going to continue to find other things. Maybe it's the carton of Haagen-Dazs to try to make yourself feel whole, when really the only thing that's going to fill that void is God.
That makes a lot of sense. So again, very, very powerful, and I'm sure a very, very challenging way to continue and work on this. We just finished the Holiday of Purim, probably the time this episode is live, it's going to be, you know, before or around Pesach time, there's a lot of alcohol in the way that we celebrate. Some of it is required, right? Sometimes it's a mitzvah obligation to have alcohol as part of the celebration. And sometimes it's just a very strong custom. How can we better, like as a community, how can we better navigate these types of situations, keeping in mind that we may be surrounded by individuals who have alcohol use disorder?
You know, the truth is I am around alcohol all the time. And I am at an event like, you know, 4 or 5 nights a week. My husband still drinks. For me, I just can't. It's not an option. But it's not his obligation or anyone else's obligation or my religion's obligation. My sobriety is my responsibility. And if I feel like I am feeling spiritually fulfilled, then I don't feel triggered by being around alcohol. I think this is the world we're living in. We're never going to be able to shield ourselves from that. There's a liquor store on every corner. People drink at breakfast, lunch, and dinner in New York City, and it's socially acceptable. So we're never going to be able to avoid these types of situations. So I would say that that's the obligation of the person who knows that this is not an option for them. I also want to say that, like, my husband can have 2 glasses of wine at the Seder, and then he'll do the 2 glasses of grape juice because he's not an alcoholic. He can do that. He can leave half a glass of wine. I could never do that. I look at that and I'm like, are you going to finish that? But I think if there are certain people who can get drunk on Purim and then not drink until Pesach, and that's just how their mind works. But if you are a person who this is a normal behavior pattern for you, and you wake up hungover and you drink some more, you know, alcoholism is a self-diagnosed disease. So only you can really understand if you have a problem. And one of the first things that somebody told me in recovery was, if you think you have a problem, you do. Because people who aren't alcoholics don't seek out recovery meetings or recovery programs. I know for me, there was a lot of denial, and I was highly concerned about the Jewish holidays. I got sober in August, and knowing that Rosh Hashanah was around the corner, and my last blackout happened in the synagogue on Shabbat, or started. There's alcohol all around our religion. So if you are a person who has a problem with alcohol or other substances, you need support for these types of situations. And if you have that support, if you have somebody that you can call before walking into a Passover Seder or before walking into a Purim party, and you know that somebody's going to be waiting for your call when you leave, you're accountable and you're not in it alone. So I would suggest to anyone out there who may be struggling, make sure that you have some sort of support. And, you know, it's weird to call strangers, but that's what has carried me through the past 2.5 years. And I use the tools.
That makes a lot of sense. I know you're very active on social media. One thing that seems to come up a lot is this concept of, I call it, I don't know if I made this term up of, or this is a real thing, I call it mommy wine culture. Mm-hmm. This concept of like, oh, just, you know, a glass at the end of the day. Oh, you know, adulting is hard. Parenting is hard. You know, hashtag wine, all of that. And unfortunately, we have seen a tremendous spike in the amount of women, specifically younger women, who have begun to have struggles with alcohol to the point where they actually have, you know, significant sequela, whether it's liver damage or sort of, you know, permanent things or semi-permanent things that happen as a result of amount that they drink. So what are your thoughts on like this whole kind of, you know, wine culture and the encouragement of, you know, numbing or dealing with life using alcohol?
It's funny you should ask me that. I took my girls shopping yesterday, and we were in this kid's store, and they offered me a glass of wine. And I was like, is that normal? Like, I'm in a children's store. And I would have loved it. The truth is, like, I would have loved it in my active drinking. I would have loved it. I would have hung out until closing time. and like enjoyed my wine while my kids were shopping. And honestly, like I'm not here to judge at all. Like, I don't really care what anyone else does. For me, I cannot have a glass of wine when I'm with my kids, because I know that that will turn into a bottle, and I've been down that road. You know, I do think the normalization of drinking at all hours is dangerous, because there are people out there like me who can't just have one. I'm only really here to worry about myself and my own sobriety. And, you know I can't have that glass of wine, and so I just don't. But, you know, I do know how attractive it can be to escape the hours between 5 and 7 PM when your kids are, you know, struggling. And that is, and, you know, I've had to learn other tools to cope with that time. You know, I let my kids have screen time during that time if I need it for my sanity. You know, I need to take care of myself so I can take care of them. And so even though other people may judge me for making that choice, that's what keeps me sane.
Do you find that you, when you decline alcohol at events, or like, you know, at the children's store, is there a component of judgment, or are people pretty like, okay, she doesn't want to drink, like moving on?
You know, it's funny. I was concerned about that when I first stopped drinking. You think everyone notices? Nobody cares that you're not drinking. Everyone's only thinking about themselves.
That's true.
You think that they're going to care about you. They don't. And, you know, the only people, like, I used to be this person in the crowd where, like, if somebody was like, oh, I'm not drinking tonight, I'd be like, what do you mean? Because when you're somebody who has a problem, it makes you feel better when other people are joining in with you, because then it makes it seem like you don't have a problem. Right. But I, you know, if the average person couldn't care less if you just want a club soda. And, you know, I don't even pretend anymore. I used to like go to the bar, get the club soda with the lime so it looked like a cocktail. And that is an amazing trick to use if you are self-conscious. I mean, so there you may need a bridge to make you feel comfortable in your not drinking era. But at the end of the day, really nobody cares. And if they do care, maybe they care for 1 minute and then they've moved on.
Right. And that makes a lot of sense. But I think probably as a community, I would like to continue to see more awareness about this and more, at least options, right? Non-alcoholic options at sofas and events and things like that, even for those that just don't want to drink. I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about all the amazing work you've been doing advocating for us, as Jews, and, advocating for what's happening in Israel. This wasn't always what you were doing, right? You had a blog and it was primarily fashion focused, accessories focused, et cetera. When, and more importantly, why did you make the transition to use your platform for Jewish advocacy?
I started using my platform for advocacy in general in 2017. I was suffering through numerous pregnancy losses, and I was very open about it, and nobody was talking about this kind of thing on social media. And it was like a very impulsive decision, but I saw how much it helped people and also helped me. And it was really an aha moment for me, because I realized that I could use my platform for actual meaningful purpose in an actual meaningful way beyond just, you know, making people feel good about their outfit. So I started talking about my Judaism and my passion for Israel around this time as well. And then in 2021, during the conflict in Gaza, when Israel was attacked and then Israel retaliated to defend herself, we were pummeled on social media and in the media. And I just felt an obligation as somebody with a platform to stand up for my people. But I knew this was going to be different than the other advocacy that I had done, because it was so unpopular in the mainstream. And a lot of my jobs, my followers, were not from the Jewish world. And I knew that they were not going to necessarily want to be associated with this controversial information. But I did it anyway. I wrapped myself in the Israeli flag and made a whole post about why I stand with Israel, why the IDF is the most moral, ethical army in the world. And, you know, it was a pivotal moment in my life and in my career. And I knew there was no turning back. And I spent the past 2.5 years, it aligned with the bottoming out of my alcoholism, because I was receiving death threats every day and just constant barrages of hate. And I didn't know how to cope. The only tool that I had to cope with was alcohol, was numbing out and drinking. And so the 2021 conflict is when my drinking really, really bottomed out, and it was really ugly. I had this moment of awakening where I said, I have a really important job to do, and I cannot throw my life away right now. And so that's really what made me decide to get help, because I knew that I had a very important role to play. And if I was going to be a sloppy drunk disaster, I wasn't going to be able to do it. And I wasn't going to be able to be there for my family and do everything I needed to do in this life with all the reasons God created me. So that's what was the impetus for my getting help. And then, of course, you know, since October 7th, my life has just been completely chaotic and busy. And it's, you know, I'm just grateful to be able to have a voice and have a purpose in the darkest hour of my lifetime as a Jewish person.
I think that, to me, my reaction to that is that shows a tremendous amount of strength, but also a tremendous amount of resiliency, where you had a lot of negative attention and publicity and all of that because of the work that you were doing. And at the same time, you realized that alcohol wasn't going to be an appropriate coping mechanism anymore. I think one thing that's really been a challenge in preventative health is this ability to be resilient. Jews are really, really struggling to be resilient right now, even those that are not so publicly advocating. Just being Jewish by itself right now is very difficult. How were you able to remain resilient given that kind of like volatile environment?
You know, resiliency is a funny thing. It's not necessarily a straight line. There are dark moments, and then there are moments where you push forward. But, you know, it's not all one thing or the other. And I think it's just about continuing to move ahead, knowing that you have to keep going. And I always think about just our ancestors and everything that they fought through so that we could be here today. I mean, we are the people of resilience. If there is any people in the world that are the people of resilience, it is the Jewish people. And, you know, we're also in a very difficult moment in the sense that there's no resolution. You know, we still have hostages in Gaza. We still have our friends, our brothers and sisters on the front lines of this battle, dying every day. So we're in it right now. So it's hard to be resilient when you can't see the other side, and when you can't know the other side. The thing that I just hang on to is my faith, honestly. Like, without that, because I have no idea what's going to happen tomorrow or even an hour from now. But I have to believe that I'm going to react in the best way that I possibly can. And that's all that we have control over. You know, I think it was Viktor Frankl who said that there's a moment between stimulus and response. And it's in that moment where we have the power to choose. So really, that is that tiny little space is all that we have. And so I think resiliency is about hanging on to that space and reacting, choosing how we react moment by moment.
You've done so many, again, just like really, really public, really visibly Jewish things on your platforms, right? I saw a clip of you recently where you were you did sort of like as if you were a hostage, right? With like shackles and covered in blood and walking through New York. And there's pictures, you know, of you dressed in an Israeli flag. It seems to me like a very scary thing. My initial reaction when I see those things is, oh my gosh, isn't she scared? Are you ever afraid when you do these sort of public ways of advocacy and of calling attention to what's going on in Israel? And how do you overcome that fear?
Sometimes I get a little bit afraid before I do it. Like before I did the video dressed as the female hostage, I had a very sick feeling in my stomach. But it was more like, I can't believe that people are actually living through this.
That
And
this really
now,
happened.
yeah. And you know something? I really don't feel fear when I'm actually in these moments. I feel a fire of purpose. Like, this is what we have to do. It's an act of desperation. You know, what choice do we have but to do everything we can? And like, I don't want to look back on this moment and feel like I didn't do everything I possibly could. And that means sometimes making a scene to bring awareness, shouting in my megaphone. I got into a fight with a police officer a couple of weeks ago because of my megaphone. And my assistant was like, "You're gonna get arrested." I was like, "Good. I hope they arrest me. That'd be great." I mean, I think sometimes we have to, because the irony is, you know, the pro-Palestinian protesters get violent. They close down bridges and streets, and they're not getting arrested. But me and my megaphone, you know, I'm like, that, what does that say? And we are rule followers as a people, but sometimes we have to make a little trouble within reason. And I just think, you know, I'm not afraid to do that. I think we have to do that. And you know, that's people, shock value is the only way to wake people up sometimes. And we are a sleeping people. A lot of the Jewish people are asleep, and the outside world is for sure asleep. So it is time to wake up because the world is on fire.
To wrap it up, if you could have one message to send to Jews who are hesitant to be publicly Jewish, are hesitant to speak up in a, you know, non-Jewish workplace or around their non-Jewish friends and colleagues to say anything that could potentially be seen as controversial, I'm going to put that in quotes, right? Or anything that potentially could be seen as provocative. What would you say? Because you seem, you know, you seem brave, you seem resilient, but not everyone's like that. I certainly am not. So what message would you have to people like that?
My message is, what legacy do you want to leave behind in this world? Think about the end of your life and knowing that you could have done something to make a difference, but you stayed silent out of fear, or you held back in acting out of fear. This is not the time to be afraid. We have to step up to the plate. This is our moment. We have to find our inner courage because we don't want to let this time pass us by and feel like we didn't speak up, like we didn't stand up, like we didn't show up. We have to, because if not us, then who? There is nobody else to stand up on our behalf. So we cannot afford to sit back, and we cannot afford to be silent.
I love that. Powerful words, powerful message. I want to thank you so much for coming on
Thank
and
you.
sharing your story, sharing your experience.
My
Very
pleasure.
inspirational. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the JOMA podcast. We welcome your feedback and ideas for future episodes. Send us an email at health@joma.org. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review us on your favorite podcast platform.